All right, good evening, everyone. This is Andrei Stepanovic at Reading Odyssey. It is August 15th, 2017, and we will be discussing two plays tonight, both called Electra, one by Sophocles and one by Euripides. And we will, unfortunately, Professor Rahm, who was originally slated to be with us tonight, he is not going to be able to make it tonight. But we will have our discussion with our regular group. So I'd like to open up the conversation first with any favorite passages or any questions that you have. I also have a good question that I got from Alan that we can use to start the discussion as well. But let me see if others have some questions or observations or favorite passages first.
This is Bill. You know, a general one that this reading these two, you know, essentially the same story side by side really brings home is how careful you need to be. You kind of get lulled into treating these stories as like at least quasi-historical. You know, these were real people doing real things. But when you read, you know, like I say, two in parallel with very different interpretations, you realize how much, you know, there's really no history involved in this. It's just the playwrights making points about people, right? And the characters are just purely fictional characters with, you know, each playwright having their own, you know, agenda in terms of what they have these characters do and say. But it's easy to forget that. You know, I think the same thing happens when we watch movies that we know aren't historical, but because they're the best representation we have, we kind of, again, let ourselves be lulled into belief. Instead of suspending disbelief, we lull into believing things that we really shouldn't.
Right. We accept that narrative as some sort of, source of some sort, right?
Yeah, it's an account of something that might have happened that way, but really not at all.
Yeah, and we have the Oresteia, which we read earlier in the spring, as sort of a basis for these two plays that are more focused on one of the characters in the Oresteia. One of the lesser influential characters in Agamemnon's telling of it, but now very, very prominent, right? Very prominent by Sophocles and Euripides. Great. Other people want to weigh in?
This is Scott. I first of all just have a pointless brag. I just came back from Greece.
And
of course, you know, visited the theater of Dionysus where these plays were first performed, which, you know, was an amazing feeling. And also, of course, right next to that is the Mars Hill, you know, which is where, I guess, the trial of Orestes was supposed to have taken place. So it was, it was amazing to come back from there and read these plays. Of course, realize that I was reading about the very hill that Orestes was tried on. The question I had for people is, I read them both together kind of at the last minute, and I have to say I liked Euripides' play much better. I meant to go back and read The Libation Bearers and see how that compared, because I had very good memories of that. But I wondered if other, you know, what play did other people prefer?
Good. Great.
This is Elizabeth. I much preferred Sophocles, actually, the opposite from you. I thought it was just, you know, brilliant.
Is this Nan, by the way?
No, this is Elizabeth.
Oh, Elizabeth, hi, good. It's a little hard to hear you.
It's because I'm on a cell phone. Maybe I'll...
Oh, okay. Okay, that's a little better. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Sorry. I like Sophocles much better. I thought the dramatic the dramatic tension and dramatic irony was really terrific. It was even better than Oedipus Rex or Oedipus Rex. I thought that Euripides sort of almost seemed comic because it didn't seem unified to me. It seemed to be sort of lurching. I mean, I read them quite a while ago. I haven't read them recently. I read them, you know, a month or two ago when we first, even longer, in fact.
Okay.
But I loved the Sophocles. I thought it was really a masterpiece, and more like a modern play.
So Sophocles' version was a bit more tense for you, dramatic, and so on. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, the audience constantly knows things that the characters don't know. I like that a lot.
Okay. Good. As for Euripides, what would we say about Euripides' version? Is it less tense, or if so, what? How could we characterize it? How could we describe Euripides'
version? This is Nan.
Yeah,
Nan. This is Nan. I preferred Euripides' version only because I felt it seemed to me more of a drama, in more dialogue, and more the language was easier to understand. It wasn't as formal or what we're kind of used to in Greek drama. And maybe it's because I read it second, and so I this is like basically the third time I've heard the story, so I kind of knew the story, and maybe that's why it seemed easier to read to me. But it just seemed to me more easier flow, a more natural flow to the dialogue and
Does the language sound more colloquial in Euripides in any way? Does anybody?
This is Harry. I also enjoyed the Euripides version more than the Sophocles. I don't know. There was a couple of times in there I laughed. I thought he had a subtle sense of humor that came through, and maybe it was like somebody said earlier, you know, after you read the Sophocles, then you read the Euripides, you know the story, this is the third time around, and maybe you see some things you didn't see before. But I enjoyed the Euripides version.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Stuart. Oh, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
Stuart?
Yes. Okay, Stuart, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I liked Euripides' version. For several reasons. One, I liked the fact that there was more ambivalence about the characters, that we had a sympathetic Clytemnestra. And also that I thought it was a very powerful ending where Orestes and Electra kind of began to doubt their whole premise for their vengeance after they had committed the murder. In other words, they didn't go off triumphant, but sort of were racked by guilt and doubt. So I like those aspects of the Euripides version. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the structure of the Sophocles version, but I thought it was a lot tighter. But I like sort of the character changes of the Euripides version.
Yeah. So Euripides version. I don't know if the characters are more complex, but the issues seem to get a little bit more difficult. But yes, the Sophocles version, Elizabeth, would you agree that it somehow Electra's a little bit more, I don't know if she's more heroic or I don't know. It's hard to...
Stephen, preferred Sophocles. I preferred it for a couple of reasons. One was I really had a hard time stomaching the deus ex machina ending of Euripides with Castor and Pollux showing up to tell you what's going to happen in the rest of it. So giving up the Eumenides at the end. I didn't really care for Euripides' kind of flippant approach to a lot of it, and I don't know the character. I loved the play, both of them, but Sophocles struck me as really tragic, and Euripides struck me as kind of a domestic squabble that just it just went bad, and I don't know. It was just a very different feel to it. Maybe because of the colloquial translation that went with it. I don't know. But Sophocles, I have to admit that the other part of Sophocles is that Richard Strauss orchestrated it to make it into his Elektra, and that is one of the greatest operas ever composed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that I think you, did you send that out, links to that earlier in the, I don't know, a few weeks ago or so?
Yeah, right after the session, I sent out a link for the Idomeneo, which has Elektra in it, and the full version of Elektra.
Yes, it's very good. So he used Sophocles' version, you say, right? And there's also a film version by Michael Kakayanis, which is, I believe, more of the Euripides version, which is a very good film from 1962. It's really good. Okay, so good. So we're starting to look at some of the differences, I guess, between the two versions, and I think they're both complex. I think they both show Elektra as a complex character, but there's a difference in her portrayal in both. Let me bring up this larger question before I forget. And this is something that Alan Davis had sent out maybe a few weeks ago, And the question is, what is there about Elektra, either her character or the story that she's a part of, that make her character at least so enduring that these two playwrights would both devote, you know, a whole play to her. And then the second part is it how paradoxical is it that a female character in a very male kind of chauvinistic society like the Greek society, how paradoxical is it that Elektra would be, you know, the main character, main focus in these two plays. So,
Stephen, again, as to the last question, I don't really think it's all that paradoxical at all, because if you take a look at the contents of the book, we've got the Trojan women, Helen, Medea, two Elektras. I think that there was a fair representation of women among some of the Greek plays.
Mm. Especially in Euripides' plays. Is that right? Can we say that? At least according to what we have here, right? Yeah.
Oh, and okay. I forgot Antigone. You know, so we've got 16 plays and 16 have women titles. Maybe more than that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's good. Why is Elektra as a female character? Why is she so, you know, why is she so, I guess, powerful? You know, what's so powerful? What's so appealing about her character, or maybe her dilemma?
Has been said on these calls, you know, the position of women was very subordinate and expected subordinate. And that's one reason that Clytemnestra is so condemned. And so Elektra certainly is extremely subordinate, you know, very unfortunate, you know, presented differently in different plays, but you have to present someone, I mean, that's a challenge for a dramatist, to present someone who actually, does act and actually kills her own mother. mother. So that's, doesn't physically do it, but, you know, participates in it. So that seems like a very intriguing character. It's not as unusual today, you know, to find a woman who murders, you know, as a character or person in real life. But at the time, I suppose it was, you know, more striking, more bizarre, actually.
Yeah, and Elektra is all the more, I guess, contrasted by her sister, right? Is that Chrysothemis?
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
Right? Her sister's a prophet female.
Yeah. So we get these representations, and then we have Clytemnestra, as you said, as well, who is, you know, a very forceful character throughout, in a way, tries, in a sense, she almost takes, you know, Agamemnon's place, in a sense, at least, as the family's head. Now, Aegisthus is, as a male, becomes the male head of the family. But as far as the immediate family is concerned, it becomes Clytemnestra.
To say, this is Bill. If we had a scholar on, I think the question I'd want to ask is, in these plays, there is clearly a lot of thinking and concern about the proper role of women, right? There's some pretty eloquent dialogue about what the woman's place should be and the outrage of a woman like Clytemnestra, you know, setting herself up to rule. Which makes you think that even in ancient times when women seemed clearly subordinate, it was not a settled issue, right? That the proper role and standing of women in society in ancient Greece and probably in Rome was not simply settled. That a lot of time was spent trying to whether it was to justify what their standing of the time was, or to potentially question whether that, you know, the accepted wisdom about women was wrong. There just seems to be a lot of ink spilled on that question, which probably means that women were not entirely satisfied with the position they were in, and, you know, at least the more sensitive of their men folk fretted about that in some form or other.
Yes, yes, that's an excellent observation, yeah. And let me add that there are some scholars that have put forth or proposed that even though Greece in the classical age is you know, portrayed as pretty chauvinistic, there are some that using the evidence of, you know, Homer's epics and how women are portrayed there, and maybe some other evidence before that of civilization before that, that the patriarchal society, which is being portrayed in these plays, may have been preceded by a more matriarchal society, and that women have not completely let go of their position as having authority in a more, you know, in a more dominant way. So I don't know much more about it than that, but it's always intrigued me whenever I've read, you know, reread Homer. And you know, Penelope, of course, is not being portrayed as the you know, monarch of Ithaca, but nobody really can act, nobody can really take over unless she marries them. And so that's just one, you know, one thing that I've heard. But it's a really good observation, yeah.
Yeah, and this is Nan, and going back to what you were saying about Clytemnestra being kind of the head of the family, but even at the towards the end of Euripides' play, Elektra is saying how Aegisthus was not really in control or in charge, and that people made fun of him, the town people, and that the man's the wife's the husband, or the woman is the man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's shameful if a woman leads the house and not the man. And so they kind of do say Clytemnestra is the one who's in power.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But people were actually being, you know, but it wasn't necessarily accepted, or they didn't, it was shameful is what the play says.
It's funny that her daughter is the one who's supposed to be saying that. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Regardless of attitude, I mean, anybody who's an artist is going to be looking at the real people and how people really are, not just what they're supposed to be. So there's going to be something, you know, they wouldn't have been celebrated dramatists if their characters were lifeless and not the way real individuals are. And even in an oppressive society that's oppressive toward one group, the individuals in that group are still human like everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think, you know, Alexa certainly is not a prototype.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is not your typical family. This is a family that's at the top of the heap, right? They're in power. And so nominal power but influence as well within the family is going to play out as far as how the authority over the whole community is used. But on the other hand, there are some universal family antagonisms and issues that can resonate with anybody, right? Mother, son, mother, daughter, husband, wife, etc. And I don't know. I think they both capture that. You know, they capture those issues in different ways. But Euripides seems to bring out some of the strengths and weaknesses a little bit more between mother and son, for instance, even between brother and sister, where Electra seems to be a much more dominant force than even Orestes is in Euripides. I don't know, would Orestes have killed Aegisthus without Electra, you know, without Electra's prompting in Euripides? Versus Sophocles, you know, where Orestes seems pretty already determined and resolute to do it.
Right, right. And then there's horribly vivid scene with Orestes recounts how he killed Odysseus, you know. I would have just as soon not read that.
I couldn't hear that.
Yeah. Can you say that again, Elizabeth?
I'm so sorry. It's my terrible cell phone. The scene where Orestes recounts how he killed Odysseus, which is so bloody with the animal, you know, blood and all that. I was very repelled by that. That's all.
Yeah. Which version was that? Sophocles?
That's Euripides.
Euripides. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. No, I was agreeing with you that Euripides, he presents the murder as not obvious. I mean, the audience knows what will happen, of course, but the way he presents it, maybe it won't happen.
Yeah, yeah. Good, yeah. Is there any sympathy for Aegisthus in Euripides' version?
Yeah.
Because here he is, right? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, no, he's a lot more sympathetic in the Euripides version than in the other two versions. I wanted to make another point, though, that occurred to me, and I wonder how the Greek audiences would have responded to this. I mean, as opposed to some of the other plays, I mean, here we have sort of a spin-off of the, you know, of the major epic of the, you know, the story of the war, the Trojan War, including the event that sort of sparked what's happening in the House of Atreus, which is, you know, the murder or the sacrifice of Electra's sister, Iphigenia. And in some way, it's kind of an interesting backdrop because it sort of hints at the vulnerability of the daughters, you know? I mean, it's not said directly, but I think there's some, you know, we get a sense of how helpless Electra is in both of the situations, both in Sophocles, in different ways, both in Sophocles and in Euripides. And I think there's some parallel or some connection to how her sister was just an easy and natural victim, which is something that Clytemnestra, you know, especially in the Euripides version, was very much on her mind in terms of her justification for, as one of the reasons for killing Agamemnon.
Yes, yes, that's a good point. Yeah, and Euripides did write a play called Iphigenia too, and so, but yeah, that plays an important, you know, that's one of the main, influences on Clytemnestra wanting to get revenge. Absolutely, if not the main one. So, yeah. Yeah, how does that?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you can continue because I had a question about something else, but we can continue on this for a while.
I was just going to say, how does Electra knowing that her own sister had been sacrificed, you know, how does that play into her whole ability to comprehend this situation? And then her father being killed by her mother and all. I mean, it's just awful, you know, terrible trauma after trauma of her. Like at the beginning of Michael Kakianis's film, she basically sees the murder of her own father. And I guess it's understood that her sister had already been killed 10 years before that. But she seems such a, you know, helpless character at that point. But then as she grows older and her brother comes back and she has finally, you know, the decision to make to try to resolve the situation, and it becomes a violent, you know, violent means to an end, so to speak. She seems very determined in both plays, Sophocles and Euripides, but it almost seems like the other characters react to her her lead a little differently in each of the plays. That's I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, one of the things I observed is Euripides.
Yes, it's a little hard. I couldn't hear you. It sounded like you cut out. Hello? Is that Stephen? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. How does Electra seem to be presented in each of them? Is she presented in somewhat similar fashion? And how is Orestes portrayed in relation to her? You know, in each of the.
To me, Electra was kind of portrayed the same. I mean, there's the wailing and the lamenting and the sorrow, and but to me, I never get a sense of her even thinking about her sister. It's like she's single focused on Clytemnestra killed my father, or my mother killed my father. And even in Euripides at the end, when Clytemnestra gives her speech about what, you know, not only did he kill your father, he brought Cassandra home and shared the bed, you know, and I had two wives then. And Electra just, she doesn't seem to focus on anything but you killed my father.
Yeah.
Like, very single-minded to me.
Yeah.
Well, you killed my father and you've treated me poorly. Right, I mean, she has a big that other grievance besides her father. I think in both plays, right, that she was treated poorly by her mother and particularly her stepfather. So that kind of extended her grievance, I think.
Yeah, the word slave comes up a lot in terms of her character, that she is either a slave or at least feels like a slave. Right, she's married to a peasant in Euripides's version. That's good.
this is Elizabeth. One of the things that I kept wondering is she so much admires her brother, and she's been waiting for the brother. But what's the brother been doing all this time? I mean, that doesn't seem to bother, you know, like in Sophocles, the brother has been in some athletic competition and did very well, and he's made a very good name for himself. And I kept thinking, well, why don't you go and help your sister, which is so important. If it's such an important task for you, and maybe this is just part of the story that's so well known that the playwrights didn't think they had to tell it. I don't know, but it isn't told why he delayed.
Wasn't he going to be killed by Aegisthus if he came back?
Yes,
well,
I think in
right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. He was, but he does come back. So I'm just saying, why is he?
That's after Apollo orders him, but that's after the oracle tells him he has to go back and kill his mother.
That's
when
true.
He goes back,
because
the god decreed it.
Yeah, that's in Euripides. But my question is, that's not part of the play. You know, that's not something that we're kind of shown in the play. So what was happening? You know, what's the backstory? We know about Orestes, we don't know about Orestes.
Right. What's implicit, right, is that he is still young when Agamemnon is killed, and so is Electra. And so Orestes can't return until he's of age, and being of age meaning an adult that can actually take over the throne, right? So maybe... And he's been in refuge, or he's been, you know, under protection by a neighboring or a king that is willing to keep him safe. So I think, I don't know, if I'm wrong, let me know. But I think that he is waiting until he actually has he's at the age where he can legitimately reclaim the throne. And the only problem is that in order to do that, he may have to kill, you know, Aegisthus to get it. I'm just saying that could be an implicit thing, because the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece is also a very similar story. He returned, and in order to get his birthright to the throne, he would have had to supplant the person who had taken it by force. So I don't know. That's would anybody else want to weigh in? Because that's what I've always kind of.
But then he doesn't. He has to flee. You know.
Yeah, but eventually, when he returns, he could be killed. You know, and I think he is. I think it is, at least in one of the plays, where it's said that, you know, Aegisthus is willing to kill him if he can, you know, so that he won't have to contest the throne, I guess.
Right. Aegisthus is willing to kill him, but also, isn't it in Euripides that it's raised that that Aegisthus' children will then kill Orestes?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Aegisthus, his relatives, will then kill Orestes.
Yeah, I, you know, that's always a possibility, right? We could have a civil war. And so, yeah, this is a really, really critical moment, you know, in every sense of the word. Nobody knows how it's going to turn out. And I think in Sophocles... Right? Did you get a sense, Elizabeth, that in Sophocles the chorus and the people kind of were much more had much more trepidation as far as, you know, what was going to happen and how it was going to play out? I don't know. It seemed to me like maybe there was this underlying fear of what could happen, knowing that was a possibility. Like either side could have come out on top, I guess.
Yes,
but, yeah.
Yeah.
In Euripides, I don't know. That doesn't seem to be as much of a factor, since a lot of the action is taking place outside of the city and near the peasant's hut. So maybe not as much of the town or the city's people are as present. I mean, there is a chorus in Euripides' Electra, but they don't seem to be as, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but they don't seem to be as invested in it. And they seem to be more encouraging, in a sense, too. So.
And then that was actually what I was going to bring up earlier when I said
yeah.
to continue with the thing, was that I thought in Euripides, the chorus was, I thought in both plays, the chorus was sympathetic to Electra. But I thought in Euripides, the chorus flipped. And then all of a sudden was like, oh, Electra, what you did was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, you're a bad person. And it was like they were supporting her all the way up, and then once the deed was done, it was like, you screwed up.
Yeah, it's almost
and
like
I didn't get that. That kind of confused me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Euripides gets very complicated, you know, at the end there, you know? Yeah. Yeah, is Euripides...
I just wondered if anybody else felt the same thing, that the chorus, kind of changed gears. In Euripides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was my question.
And what is that saying? Yeah, what is that saying? Yeah, anybody else?
I mean, maybe the chorus was convinced by Clytemnestra's defense. I mean, I do think, you know, Euripides in the end gives the most sympathetic portrayal of her situation, and you know, even Orestes and Electra are second guessing that they did it, so I guess it's no surprise that the chorus might also no longer be as certain. And you know, I mean, one thing that makes it, at least I feel like it makes it hard for us, or for me anyways, is, you know, from our point of view, the slaughter of the daughter by Agamemnon, I think most people in our time would think that was a bigger crime than Clytemnestra murdering Agamemnon, right?
Yeah.
That what Agamemnon did was far more evil and far more deserving of death. And you get the feeling Euripides might have felt that way too, but that's what I'm not sure. You know, it's, you know, there clearly was a much bigger deal about, you know, murdering your father in the other tellings of this play, and certainly in Orestes and Electra's mind, that's the worst of all crimes.
Yeah.
Yet I think for us, what Agamemnon did was much worse.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Agamemnon is not only the father, right, of that nuclear family, he's the head of the larger household, and he's the king of the people. And so, for them, right, that's almost a triple no-no. You know, you not only killed Agamemnon, you've killed him in all these different roles. And yet, him killing his daughter with his authority as head of the household, according to the ancient, you know, Greeks, and it's even the ancient Romans in really traditional sense, the head of the household in Rome had the legal right to slay his own children. I know it sounds awful, crazy, but you're right. That would have been more pardoned, more able to be pardoned and accepted than, I think, a wife killing a husband. Yeah.
Yeah, which is just weird. Although, you know, again, like, and as Clytemnestra says, he Agamemnon did it on behalf of that slut Helen. So the word, at least the way it was translated.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't even a legitimate cause for sacrifice, is her point. It was like such a waste of my daughter's life to do that on behalf of Helen, of all people.
Now that is great, because that brings up something that Euripides brings
out. Aren't they
sisters? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you call your sisters a slut. I love that.
Exactly, exactly. That's fascinating. And then Castor and Pollux are related to Helen and Clytemnestra as well, because they're the brothers, right?
Right,
or at least
right.
They're related. So
no, they're brothers. They're brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fascinating how this all kind of comes out, and it's always been there, but in Euripides, he likes to bring this. It just complicates things more, you know. It's fascinating.
But I also liked how Euripides complicated it with Electra's kind of counter-argument to Clytemnestra's defense, when she was basically saying, you were hunting harm, is the phrase the Euripides uses, like, because she was concerned with her beauty while her husband was away. And
she was combing her hair. She combed her hair.
You wouldn't
right
want,
after.
You know, if you weren't hunting harm, you wouldn't want to look good for outsiders. Because she says, so even before Iphigenia was sacrificed, you were looking elsewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The scandal is starting to widen. Exactly. That's good. Was that in Euripides?
Yes.
That in Euripides?
Yes.
Yeah. He likes to really push that, you know, push the envelope there. So... yeah, so how innocent is Clytemnestra, really, you know? Good.
Another point about Euripides and Clytemnestra, and maybe you already covered this because I dropped off, unfortunately, is the question I had, where she is so casual about, oh, well, maybe I made a mistake. I almost see her filing her nails as she says, oh, well, perhaps it was a mistake to have murdered him. But it's done, so now we move on. And that casualness plus the combing of the hair is, for me, what exemplifies this Clytemnestra.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
On the subject of the chorus, actually the chorus plays a kind of interesting role in the Sophocles version too. I mean, it's very interesting, the sister that Sophocles inserts both here and of course in Antigone. But here the chorus keeps saying, you know, to Electra, you know, why don't you listen to reason? Sometimes it's a good idea to listen to other advice and so on and so forth. That's a very interesting, powerful, I mean, they're sympathetic to Electra, but they're also sort of sympathetic to, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Chrysothemis. And to the idea of sort of adapting. And that's an element that's not in the Euripides. I mean, in other words, that the fact that there's another way to go other than... or at least I don't recall it from the Euripides version, that there's another way to go, which is not to seek revenge. I don't know.
Interesting.
Well, and I think that goes along with Sophocles' whole theme, as I see it, as woman on the edge, because Electra is just short of complete madness through much of the play. And there's her sister who is... I've always seen it as trying to talk her off the ledge and saying, you know, maybe there's another way. You know, this isn't the only thing you can do, because, you know, stop and think about it in your own house. If your sister was always talking about killing your mom and dad, even stepmom and stepdad, you know, or mom and stepdad, you know, it's just not the done thing in the best families.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, I think she has a really important, Chrysothemis has this really important role, even though she's not as forceful, it seems, as Electra. But she has this sort of, I mean, I know, it may be seen as submissive, but in another sense, it may be seen as more of a rational, you know, kind of approach. And I was just thinking about her name, Chrysothemis, Chryso means gold, and Themis, I think, has to do with justice, I think. Or at least there's a there's a goddess. Yeah, it's justice. So I know it may be a coincidence, but her name means literally golden justice. I'm not saying Chrysothemis is right. I'm not saying she's the one that, you know, is going to solve everything. But she does have a role that maybe we shouldn't neglect, you know, as far as what if her influence won out and not Electra's, you know? Would there be any killing? And if not, then what would be the outcome of all this, you know? Who knows?
And the one thing I found with Sophocles is with Electra, there's much more reference to anger. And I started writing down like all the different line numbers that talked about her anger, and then I stopped because it started getting, you know, it was a lot.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Because like in the beginning it says, trust him with your too painful anger. And then it says, not to indulge yourself in useless anger. And then there's another line where it says, do not turn to anger. The chorus says that to Electra. So it's she's much more angry, I felt, in Sophocles. And it's almost like the rage is what's blinding her.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed too that in Euripides, a lot of the word justice, and I'm sure it came up in Sophocles too, but it just came out a lot more to me in Euripides, justice. And yeah, at the end, I'm still wondering what is justice? And maybe even Electra and Orestes are thinking, what is justice? Did we do, you know, something that is justice or did, or what, you know? So I think that's good. I think Sophocles, the anger is much, very prominent there. Yeah, yeah. And the anger in Euripides may not be as you know, prominent as opposed to maybe some other themes, like maybe justice. I don't know. But I think you're absolutely right about the anger in Sophocles. Yeah.
Hey, Andre, kind of following along that line, I had a observation, and I missed it. In Electra, I mean, in Euripides, Electra, she actually is there and participates in the murder of her mother.
Yes.
Pushes the knife in. Yet she doesn't suffer any of the penalties that Orestes is facing. I mean, she loses her brother and all that, but, you know, she doesn't suffer anything. And I can't quite figure out why Euripides writes that. In Sophocles, you know, Electra and Orestes, there's the plans with the murders, and they seem to be escaping this murder scot-free.
Yeah. Orestes seems to bear the brunt of that. Is that what you're saying? In Sophocles, yeah, but how does he right? How does he or she escape that accountability in Euripides? Is that right? Am I right? Yeah. Let's see. Let's take a look at that. Especially the end of the play. Let's see if I can find the page. That's a good point. Okay. I'm gonna turn back to the end of Euripides here. Line. One thing I noticed. Line 965 or so. Orestes. This is where Orestes is, and this is 967, I think. Orestes is saying, what shall we do? Can we really kill our mother? And then Electra says, you're sorry for her now, you see her really? So there, that was a pretty like fascinating moment there where Orestes is sort of hesitating, Electra is not. And yet, right? Who cannot, you know, who couldn't identify with that? I mean, how difficult would this be for someone who just came back, right, from exile, hasn't seen his mother or his sister or anybody for years, and yet, and now he's supposed to kill her as soon as he sees her, you know? I thought that was really interesting because Clytemnestra has quite a bit to say before Orestes or Electra, is it Electra who kills her? Before Clytemnestra is killed. And that gives Orestes a chance to actually, you know, interact with her a little bit. And at the same time, it's mentioned as a ritual, you know, a terrible ritual slaughter on line 1176 or something like that. So let's see here.
My question is really rooted on it. If you go down to line about 1300,
okay.
Now you have Castor. Says fate and necessity brought you to us to this, what must be, in the words of Apollo, so foolish are also to blame. Mm-hmm. And then Electra says, Tenera's sons may also join in the discussion, da 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 da. Then she says, but what about me? What Apollo, what oracle made me murderer of my own mother? And Castor says, you shared any action. What was the curse on the whole family? That was the thing that was torn you apart. But she, you know, doesn't have to go off and do the purification stuff that Orestes does. She just sort of, you know, has to say goodbye to her brother.
Yeah.
Well, and she's told to marry Pylades. Right? Which is neither here nor there unless we know more about him.
But did Electra physically kill her mother, or she created the plot and got everything ready for Orestes to do it?
Yeah, 1225, I held the sword with you. Now,
okay.
I urged you on. Now, did she actually plunge the sword in? Orestes says he did it in the line right before that. But she apparently feels, you know, they both pretty much felt like they did it jointly, although since Orestes actually put the sword in his mother, I guess that's the difference, right? Electra was right there urging him.
Yeah, but you can also understand Electra's feeling of guilt if you consider that it was on her mother to be there to be killed.
You know, yeah, she was definitely.
I'll tell them I'm going to have a baby.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But what we haven't mentioned is the guy who really plotted it was neither of them. It was the tutor, right? He's the one who told them what to do very specifically, right? Euripides?
Yeah.
He gave them very, very detailed instructions on what they had to do to kill Agestes and their mother.
No,
so, I mean, that
plotted Agestes' death, but Electra was the one who came up with how she was going to get Clytemnestra out there.
Hmm.
Is that right? I don't recall. I thought he instructed them on both.
Yeah, let's take a look at line 610. This is where the discussion is between Orestes and the old man. The old man seems to instruct Orestes where to find Agestes and then urges him to kill Agestes. Now, I don't recall if it goes any farther than that, but he definitely.
Well, he says, kill him and kill your mother.
Okay, yeah, that's line 613 or so.
See, but it says in line 650, yes, fine, and what's your plan for killing mother? And Alexa says to the old man, sir, go to Clytemnestra, please, and say, I've given birth. A baby is a boy.
Okay, good. Yeah, so Electra is sort of more or less engineering that part of it, right? She's taking the the lead on how to plan to kill her mother. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And there's quite a bit of back and forth there with the old man. Orestes, meanwhile, I guess is just sort of, he's there and he participates in it, but it's mostly Electra, it seems. And Orestes just constantly throws out these, if someone shows the way, I'm set to go. And what else? Yeah, he doesn't seem to be taking the lead as much, but he's there. So
seems a little Hamlet-like, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. But he's ready to kill Aegisthus, I think. I think that's not in any doubt. But as far as the other, as far as going on to kill the mother, who is portrayed, you know, somewhat arrogant, but still somewhat, I don't know, a little sympathetic, it's harder for him to do that. And so Electra finds herself right next, side by side with him when when Clytemnestra is actually killed. You know, it's what it takes for Orestes to do it. Whereas in Sophocles, I think Orestes does it by himself, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he's...
Yeah. And again, in line 1223, took up my sword to act out the right, R-I-T-E. And then Castor mentions it as well, 1244, ritual slaughter. While Clytemnestra is performing a sacrifice, she is sacrificed. And there's this, and Aegisthus was sacrificing when he was killed. So this is a very strange coincidence that that their deaths are commingled and even, you know, correspond to a sacrifice, a ritual slaughter. So
yeah. It's also interesting to me, and I think relevant in all of this, how little respect Euripides has for either tradition or the gods. This is almost an anti-god play.
Okay. Yeah, Apollo, how does that... Yes, go ahead, explain that to us.
Well, Apollo is stupid. You know, his oracles were stupid. Castor and Pollux come in on really deus ex machina, and you know the description of pulling them out on pulleys. I mean, this is actually probably where one got the whole term "god from the machine."
Yeah.
So there they are floating out on this big pulley thing that they're taking off the stage. Very obviously not gods. I mean, and there's so many little jabs at. You know, he jabs at Aeschylus with the whole lock of hair and footprints kind of thing. He jabs at, there are several incidents where he jabs at the various gods in various ways. And then he calls this a ritual slaughter because Delphic Apollo ordered it. And then Castor and Pollux say, well, we hold Phoebus, you know, guilty for this, not anybody else, but you're going to have to go and expiate yourself anyway.
Yeah.
They're just utterly capricious and self-indulgent, and, you know, it's kind of like Euripides said, with gods like these, who needs them?
Oh, my gosh. And yet there's this sad, tearful goodbye between Orestes and Electra. They really, you know, they've achieved their end, but now they can't even solace each other. They can't comfort each other, and there's no shred of family left. They can't even, you know, support each other. So they've utterly destroyed and dismantled their family. In the cause of what, you know, getting revenge or are paradoxically trying to save their family. I don't know. You know, it's very, very confusing in some ways in Euripides.
Yeah, but overall, if you think about it, it was a pretty awful family anyway.
Yeah.
Pelops and Tantalus and the whole mess of them slaughtering their children and feeding them to gods and slaughtering their children and feeding them to their brother. Maybe this family needs to be different.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, it's a terrible, cursed, family. And yet the brothers, that is Castor especially, who speaks, and I think Pollux is a non-speaking role, they seem to not be as concerned about Clytemnestra, their own sister, being killed. It's just bizarre. I don't quite know what to make of it.
Well, utterly capricious. This is the gods. They don't really care much of anything except, we got to go off and save some sailors, maybe, if they were pious and good.
Hmm. So the other capricious thing, Stephen, is that what was brought up earlier with the chorus and how they seem to turn on Orestes and Electra and in Euripides' play, and how fickle the people may be. I don't know. Am I reading too much into it? Or is Euripides commenting on, the fickleness of his own people, the Athenians, perhaps, who have themselves been going through this terrible war, the Peloponnesian War with Sparta, and have been swayed one way or the other quite a few times over the whatever past 30-something years of war. I don't know. That kind of came to me near the end of this play, of Euripides' play.
Euripides seems a little cynical, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's the one who wrote the Trojan women, who are lamenting the downfall of their city, and that was staged when Athens was going through a terrible siege during the war as well, and it was considered pretty anti-patriotic, if not downright subversive. I think he's capable of that in this play too. But then again, I'm not a Euripides expert or anything, but I just kind of saw that. Now, Sophocles could be making his own commentaries as well. It's just a little bit easier for me to see it in Euripides, maybe. I look at the last few lines of Euripides' play, and this is on page 632 of our the Greek plays edition, but it's the last few lines. The chorus says goodbye, good luck, and this is after they've supported one way and then called Orestes and Electra to account, and now they're saying goodbye, good luck. If you can be lucky. Steer clear of disaster. That's happiness for mortals. Not the most uplifting ending, but yet a very, profound kind of a statement as well.
Well, you could look at it one of two ways. I kind of look at this as the equivalent of another character in Hamlet. What is his name? Polonius. Where basically they're coming up with the biggest Triteism ever to summarize what went on in the play. Goodbye, good luck. If you can be lucky. Steer clear of disaster. That's happiness for mortals. And it's like, really?
it actually kind of made me laugh along with some of the other things that Euripides did. I can't help but think that he's almost a little satirical here.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, it makes you really pause, you know. Just a few lines before, I think it's Castor saying, you know, we cannot help the polluted, that I guess referring to Orestes, maybe even Electra. We can help only those who love holiness and justice. Well, you know, that was the whole point of this, was to get justice. And yet now Orestes and Electra feel like, you know, they've maybe did something wrong. And so,
well,
I don't know.
It's interesting. It's interesting because one of the sections I liked in Euripides is kind of comical in a sense, but also kind of foreshadowing, was when Electra was talking to Aegisthus's corpse. And she says, "You still don't know that time caught up with you and made you pay. May every criminal see that he'll never win the race with justice. He may run crook at first, but play it out, run on right to the finish line of life." So, again, it's this sense, and it's almost like that's Orestes. He's going to be hounded by the Furies, although he does get off in court. But she's saying this to Aegisthus, of course, but not realizing the same thing's going to happen to Orestes. And that justice, you know, you never win the race with justice.
Very interesting. Yeah, yeah. That's good. Yeah, I like that. So what is the solution, you know? Is there any way that this family can get out of this mess, you know? Looking back at Aeschylus, right, is there some resolution at the end of the Oresteia? Is there resolution at the end of Sophocles, Electra? Is there resolution at the end of Euripides, you know, Electra? What do you guys think?
I think there is there's meant to be an Aeschylus because, you know, he folds into this whole idea of the development of, you know, the human system of justice rather than, you know, the caprices of fate. I think that's sort of like, that's why he's glorifying Athens, and I think also trying to move beyond blood feuds.
There's a formal trial, right? I mean,
that's
pretty, yeah.
Well, there's the same resolution at the end of Euripides, only it's told mockingly. You've got Castor show up and say, "Oh yeah, and this is what's going to happen. You're going to go and have a trial inside of Mars Hill, and this is going to be a really monumental trial because on the side that whenever anything is even, verdict goes in favor of the defendant." And it's like, okay, so now we've got a whole summary of the Eumenides in the last 4 minutes of of Electra. So there,
right.
And I just can't help seeing Euripides here, tongue in cheek, satirical and poking fun at everything that came before, and all the truisms you already know. It's actually one of the huge appeals for the play for me.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, he butchers Aeschylus, you know, he just says, "Oh yeah, and you remember back when Aeschylus told you that she found this golden hair sitting on the altar? Now that's really likely, isn't it?"
Oh yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, Euripides is kind of like Aristophanes. He's poking fun at his predecessors, I guess, you know. That's interesting. And yet there's so much profundity in Euripides too. I don't know. I have to go back and reread it. I think, you know, I think there's a lot there. And same with Sophocles. I mean, Sophocles, I don't know how final the resolution is compared to Aeschylus. You know, Aeschylus seems to be pretty like, yeah, I think I can agree there's some sort of resolution. Sophocles and Euripides, they may be exploring some other, like, I don't know, possibilities of, you know, whether there's a firm resolution or not. I'm not sure.
The thing with the Sophocles that I saw was that there is an enormous depth of emotion, and the thematic emotion versus the rational mind between Electra and Chrysanthemis. You've got, for me, of the three, he was the most profoundly emotional and the most devastatingly emotional, because in the opera, I don't think it happens in the play, but in the opera, basically, Electra dances herself to death on the after her mother has died.
Okay.
You know, that basically, the way they looked at it is there was this mad joy about it, which was also a guilt that tore her apart. So I don't think that Sophocles comes down as final as either Euripides or Aeschylus, but I think that there is, that thematically, he's complete.
Interesting. Yeah, and I agree with you on the emotion, too. He's very, very, very forceful in that sense. And it's much more like traditionally tragic, you know, what I would expect. The whole emotional gut kind of, my guts are really in it up for every line, you know. And Euripides, but I'm getting these question marks. I'm not sure what to feel sometimes in Euripides. So,
We go back to the resolution. Sophocles really doesn't resolve it like Euripides or Aeschylus does. He leaves it just, as the murder of Agassiz takes place. And it kind of leaves it hanging out there. What happens afterwards?
Yeah. Interesting.
I think in part because it didn't really matter to him. That wasn't really the point. What happens afterwards happens afterwards, but what happens here is that battle between the emotions and the rational, and what happens when the emotions win.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, any other thoughts on these plays? We've done a good dive into this book in the last, I think it's 6-7 months or so. And I think what's good is we've traced the thread, at least, through these three writers, and just barely touched on Euripides even. So, it's been really good, very enlightening for me. Any concluding thoughts or observations or questions?
I just wanted to thank everybody. I've really enjoyed this, and it's been been just such a great experience for me. I'm not well read in these plays, and I've learned a lot from everybody. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I
don't know.
Go ahead.
That was exactly what I was going to say. Everybody has done such a wonderful job of opening them up for me and showing all sorts of interesting things going on inside them. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah, this is Harry. I enjoyed the discussion. I got an awful lot of insights from the various comments. People come at it from different perspectives and different ways, and it's of great value. And I'm just wondering, now that we've wrapped this up, what are we on to next?
Okay, good question. I was told that we are now, or Phil at least, is looking toward the publication of the landmark Caesar. And right now, the publication of that book was slated for December, but it's still not quite confirmed. But if not December, it should be soon after that. And Phil is going to send out information, specific information, about when we could start another reading group centered around that book. And that would probably start, like I said, you know, January, February, maybe. So that's what he would like to do. I would like to be part of that too. It's a really good read. And the Landmark series, as probably a lot of you know, is a very reader-friendly series with a lot of really interesting ancillary maps and notes and stuff, which you can use, or you can just read the text, you know, straight through. With the maps, it'll make things even more interesting. But Caesar's a very good writer, in Latin and in English. So I can't wait. So yeah, good. And and then after that, who knows? You know, but at one point there is also a Polybius. Polybius wrote about the first Punic War, and that's also in the works. And maybe that'll happen after Caesar, and in between, maybe, you know, we can get back to some more of these plays. Who knows, you know, or whatever. We'll see. But I've really enjoyed this. I have to say, this edition, this group, these discussions have definitely made these plays more, you know, open to me, and I've learned a lot. So I'm just so glad that these are a source of really unending stuff to discover. These are just wonderful. These are world literature, you know, worthy writings. So
I agree.
All right.
Thank you.
Have you guys read The Nature of Things by Lucretius? Have you discussed that?
Oh, yeah, my gosh. Matter of fact, I think Phil had done a reading group with them, but I love Lucretius. I would love to do a reading group on that at some point in the future. He's really interesting. But I'll talk to Phil about it and see what translation he used for it, and see what he thinks about that, because that's really worth reading.
It's not particularly long, although it's got so much depth into it. So that would be a good filler between now and December.
I'll pass that on to Phil, but if you want to, you want to talk to him too, send him an email or call him or something.
Sure. Yeah. Enjoyed it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Okay. All right.
All right, thank you.
Very
thank
good.
You,
You're
everyone.
Welcome.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right, good night.